Welcome to the HIV Australia podcast, a discussion about the community-led response to HIV. In this episode, we hear from Professor Martin Holt from the Centre for Social Research in Health on the research study on long-term trends in gay and bisexual men's behaviour and the impacts of COVID-19. For Health Equity Matters, you're listening to HIV Australia. I'm Justin Salerno, and I am here joined by Professor Martin Holt from the Centre for Social Research in Health, here to talk about a recent study on the long-term trends in gay and bisexual men's behaviour and the recent impacts of COVID-19. Hi, Martin, and welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Could you please briefly explain a bit about the research project and its overall purpose?
Yeah, of course. So I've had the privilege of running what up until very recently have been known as the Gay Community Periodic Surveys. And this year we've just slightly tweaked the title. We're now called the GBQ Plus Community Periodic Surveys to sort of reflect a slightly wider range of people who we now incorporate into the study. And these were set up in the mid-90s to track HIV-related behaviour in Australia's most HIV-affected population, which at the time was initially gay men, and then that expanded to gay and bisexual men. And more recently, we sort of included queer men and non-binary people who have sex with gay, bi and queer men as well. But that remains our focus. And the study is conducted every year in multiple jurisdictions, not every single one. And it sort of involves during LGBTQ festival periods, we work with a local partner organisation, usually Health Equity Matters member organisations. And we approach potential participants at festival events, you know, such as Mardi Gras or Brisbane Pride, and ask them to complete a questionnaire on their sexual behaviour, their relationships, drug use, testing, engagement with health services, and so on. And then we supplement that with online recruitment. So it's been going for a very long time. I have not been involved since the very beginning, but I've been running the surveys in collaboration with our partners since 2009.
Great. So it sounds like you've got a wide range of subpopulations that were captured in the study. How did you recruit further beyond the festivals?
Yeah, so yes, that's a good question. The recruitment for the survey is traditionally very much focused on what would have been seen as gay community sites or queer community sites. So bars, clubs, sex venues, some health services, and the festival events like Fair Day in Sydney or Midsummer in Melbourne. And that gets us a lot of people in a short period of time. But there's a recognition that the epidemic has evolved and we have to follow them. So around 10 years ago now, we recognised that people were increasingly socialising and seeking out partners online. So first we added online recruitment, and we also do recruitment through apps such as Grindr as well in some jurisdictions. So obviously adding online and mobile-based recruitment extends our reach geographically. Although the majority of people, like in the Australian population, who take part are from the big cities and regional centres, with fewer from regional areas. In more recent years, we've had a more fine-grained focus on who we include in the surveys, with a particular focus on trying to boost the participation of younger participants, so guys and non-binary people under the age of 25. We can do that sometimes with online targeting, because we can focus adverts at younger people, or, you know, focus advertising through Instagram. And also in recent years, we've added multi-language support to the survey. So the paper questionnaires are just in English. The online recruitment was originally just in English, but we've added multiple languages. And so in some of the more populous states and territories, we do advertising in simplified Chinese and Thai as well, for example. And that gets us some more recently arrived gay and bisexual guys who are living in Australia.
Great. So yeah, that shows that there's a diversity among participants. The study highlights our impacts of COVID-19. Could you tell us what happened?
Yes, of course. So, I mean, we've all just lived through that, and some of us are still living with it. I think my husband just rang me to say that he's a close contact of someone who's just got diagnosed in the last couple of days, which is fun. So when COVID-19 broke, we knew it was going to have major impacts. And of course, I think most of us in that first year weren't quite sure what was going to happen. We thought it's important because the surveys have been running for so long that if we could, we should keep them going. So we had a lot of discussions with partner organizations in the different states and territories about what we should do. And luckily, as I've mentioned, we already had online recruitment as an established option in the survey. So in some jurisdictions, we pivoted entirely to online recruitment. And we just made a decision that even though people were often stuck at home and under lockdown restrictions, that wherever possible, we should try and keep the schedule going of the survey. So we had a data point during COVID-19 restrictions to see what was happening. And we weren't the only people doing this. There was lots of creativity in the HIV and sexual health space about a kind of keeping services going where necessary, but also to continue monitoring and to see what kind of health impacts COVID-19 had on the communities we work with. So we had a couple of years where we were the majority of people we recruited was online, and it was pretty successful. People are often surprised that actually face-to-face recruitment, so going out with clipboards and approaching people, is actually a more effective way of getting large numbers of people in the bigger cities because you've got a captive audience and you can get them really quickly. Online can be you're competing for eyeballs and clicks with everybody else who's online and advertising. So it can be tricky, but I think gay and bisexual men and the other people we target were all stuck at home and looking for things to do. And people were also, the surveys, the periodic surveys have good recognition. So when our partners were advertising the survey online, people responded really well. So we managed to keep them going. So that was the first achievement. And then the second thing was, well, what did COVID-19 do to gay and bisexual men's behavior? And it probably won't be a surprise to people that there are a lot of changes. So people were having far less sex, far fewer casual sex partners. They were going out much less often because they couldn't go out. Lots of people, for example, who were on PrEP paused taking PrEP or stopped taking it as much because there wasn't as much need. And people reported going for testing far less often because they weren't going to health services unless they needed to, and they were having less sex. And the one good thing that we saw in there was that HIV treatment, so people living with HIV sustaining their treatment and viral suppression, that remained completely stable. So that was fantastic. And that's sort of testimony to sort of people living with HIV and their service providers in working out ways to keep treatment uninterrupted during COVID. But yeah, things like testing, PrEP use, number of partners, all of those things really dropped during COVID. And they actually dropped for quite a long time. We actually saw at least 2 years where all of those things were quite suppressed. And then it's only in the last year or so that we're gradually seeing a return to what we might call pre-pandemic levels. PrEP use in particular has rebounded as people have gone back to having sex. Testing, I'd say, is the one where perhaps we think COVID disrupted things a lot, and people are probably still a bit wary about going to health services when they don't need to, when they feel they don't need to. And testing levels, particularly among negative guys who aren't on PrEP, still remain a bit low in most jurisdictions. So I'd say that's the one thing that stands out to me in the most recent data I've seen.
Yeah, so I guess that leads into my next question. The data from the study showed varied levels of HIV testing. Could you share with us who were the most and least likely to test?
Of course. So this actually goes for testing and for PrEP as well. Like, if you want to just consider those two things, they're not the only things that we look at, but they're good examples. So during COVID, we saw that testing and PrEP use, for example, both fell most obviously among the youngest participants, among guys under 25, among bisexual participants rather than gay identified men, and in residential areas where there are fewer gay people living, so like suburban areas and regional areas. And it was really obvious in the COVID data, you could see that Yeah, testing fell among everyone, but it fell more in those groups. So the younger guys by plus suburban areas. And also the recovery was slower in those groups as well. So we still see a bit of a lag in all of those areas. And so when I'm talking to you or your members, I'm like going, look, if you want to kind of get levels back to where they used to be, raise the floor, these are the kind of groups where we need to focus attention. And we can probably, let's say younger guys, for example, that you can imagine some reasons why health engagement might be lower among younger people. You might not have a regular doctor. The cost of attending might be more of a concern to them. They might not have as much sex as some of their older peers. And so you can see a variety of reasons why they might not be on PrEP, or they haven't made the time to go, or things like they might be more precarious employment, or they might be studying. And all of these things could get in the way of going for testing or going to get a PrEP prescription, for example. And yeah, and COVID made those things all a little bit more challenging.
Yes, I guess COVID really had a large impact on this, on I guess the way the study was performed from previous years. And I guess as well, there was a variation of levels of HIV prevention coverage based on age group. Could you share with us a little bit more about the difference of that?
Yes, of course. So one of the things we've been looking at is the different types of prevention method that different groups of gay and bisexual men use. So, and with a particular focus on the ones we know that are effective, like say condoms, PrEP, and undetectable viral load if you're living with HIV or your partner's positive. So younger guys, well, variation by age is really interesting. The younger guys, who I mentioned, the under 25s, up until very recently, condoms remained the most commonly used strategy in that group. And that sort of makes sense to me because I think if you are going through, that's probably the strategy you learn about at school and with your peers. And maybe when you're not so sexually active, that's a pretty good strategy to rely upon. So up until very recently, the under 25s most likely to use condoms followed by PrEP, and fewer people living with HIV in that age group, so not so much viral load, but they were also the group where there was the highest level of what we'd call risky practice. So negative and untested guys having condomless sex with casual partners, but you know they weren't on PrEP or undetectable themselves. So we could sort of see that group. You could go, okay, so it's condoms, PrEP, and then there's a group we kind of want to engage in more effective prevention. In the kind of middle, I'll jump into sort of the middle group. So the 30s, 40-year-olds, PrEP is the big thing there. So the thing that's really changed in the last 10 years is massive increase in PrEP uptake in that group. And it's by far the dominant sort of strategy. And there's a reasonable representation of positive guys who are undetectable and relatively small proportion who are at risk of HIV. So there's been a really, really big change there. And I think that's where we've seen the biggest gains in the epidemic in preventing infections recently. And then if we switch to the oldest group, so the 50 plus group, now if you think about this in terms of the epidemic, if you look at different age strata, the 50 plus group has the largest representation of people living with HIV, because once you get diagnosed, we put people on treatment, and that cohort ages over time. So undetectable viral load is much more visible as a strategy among the over 50s, because there's more people living with HIV in that group. PrEP has become pretty common, but there's also a reasonable level of condom use still in the over 50s. So if you think of generationally, that group is also the group that were raised with and adopted condom use. So the over 50s actually has kind of one of the most diverse range of prevention practices. So condoms, PrEP, and undetectable viral load are all represented pretty well in the over 50s. Yeah, the middle age group, the 30s, 40s, PrEP is dominant, and in the youngest group, condoms remained up until recently the most common method, but there was perhaps a group of guys we want to engage more in prevention there.
Yes, there's a very wide range of variations between age groups there, we can see. I guess I can probably already think of some from what you said, but I guess what were there any barriers to completing the project?
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. So the survey is obviously voluntary, and And it requires some people, giving us their time and then being willing to tell us, some quite personal information. We construct the surveys completely. You can complete it completely anonymously, without leaving any contact details. So that encourages people to do it. But, we are asking some very personal and explicit questions. So we rely on goodwill, that gay and bisexual guys and their partners are willing to take part. Recruitment, as I mentioned, during COVID was very heavily disrupted, so we couldn't do any face-to-face recruitment. Luckily, we had online. I will say, in the online space, we are very reliant on Facebook and Instagram advertising for the bulk of advertising across the country, and that always makes me a little bit nervous because I don't like being so reliant on one platform or method. And Facebook obviously is an aging platform as well. It was the new kid on the block for people like me, but I'm now in my 50s, so you don't see many young people actively engaged on Facebook anymore. And so we're always looking around for alternatives. We haven't quite worked out what to do with TikTok yet because, prominent advertising is not really that acceptable on that kind of platform, but we're always looking around for alternatives. The apps are pretty good. They're quite expensive to advertise on, and don't depends on who you're competing with, whether you get a good response. So those are some of the issues we face. The other thing is about the changing epidemic, about who should we be targeting for recruitment. So we like to get a big range of gay and bisexual guys and now non-binary people as well, who play in and community networks. We've increased our focus on overseas born people, so people who may not want to participate in English as well. And there are other considerations where we're always trying to think, well, like, are we following the epidemic and the people most affected as well? So with so I've mentioned before, bisexual men have always been able to take part in the survey, but the questionnaire has not necessarily always been that great for them because it's been very focused on sex with men. And we've also got a trans peers and friends who have taken part in the survey. So trans, gay guys, queer guys, who've always been eligible to take part. But similarly for them, the questionnaire has sometimes been quite restrictive in perhaps assuming that the participant was a cis gay guy. And so we've just been through a big process actually of reviewing and changing the questionnaire to try and make it a bit more inclusive of trans participants, non-binary participants, and bi plus participants. And the simplest way I can capture the change is the questionnaire from this year has quite a big break from previous years. So rather than just focusing on sex with men, we've got equal weight given to sex with men, sex with women, and sex with non-binary partners. We already capture the gender of participants, so we know whether people are trans or not. And now we're trying to catch a broader range of the sex that people have so we can more accurately describe what's going on in the broader community and people who come in and out of these networks that gay, bi, queer men and their partners play in. So I think that's very current right now. We've just been recruiting in Sydney and Melbourne and Canberra and their surrounding states and territories. So later in the year, we'll be able to have a look at those new questions and to see what people are telling us about the sex they have.
Well, Martin, thank you for sharing your research with us today. If people would like to find out more about the study, where can they find more information?
That's a great question. So if you search for GBQ plus community periodic surveys, you should get our project page on the UNSW website, which has all our latest reports for every state and territory and our other publications from the peer-reviewed literature. We do put out some short summaries on social media like TikTok and Facebook describing our latest findings as well. You can look up my Twitter profile. That's Martin X Holt on Twitter. And I usually repost things that have come out from us. And then also, we produce reports on every round of the survey for our community partners and state governments. So if you're in one of the participating jurisdictions, check in with your local Health Equity Matters partner organisation because we usually circulate the reports through them. And we usually organise local feedback as well within each participating jurisdiction, so we can talk about the results in a local setting as well.
Perfect. Thank you, Martin. And thank you so much for your time.
No worries, it's been great to talk to you.